episode 24 of season 17. Hello, I'm Lyle Troxell, and this is Geekspeak. And in the air room with me, I have Mr. Ben Jaffe, who's a software developer for Facebook, a musician, and a really great guy. Hi, Ben.
Don't try and sum me up and put me in boxes.
We also have Brian Young.
Move along, nothing to see here.
Brian has a short sleeve shirt, is a father, a programmer, and a marketing expert.
Oh, yes, thank you for that introduction.
He's also less defensive than me.
Buffalo? Today we're talking about a lot of things, and we'll just get into it by first talking about Verizon and Tumblr. How do these connect?
Verizon and Tumblr. Actually, this is more about net neutrality. So,
wait, what?
Net neutrality. So, this was an article in The Verge, and it's a little bit of putting things together. It's not entirely a fact-based article. This is the idea that one of the strongest companies in favor of net neutrality over the history of our great long debate over what is net neutrality and what the need for it is has been Tumblr. And Tumblr was founded, oh goodness, it's 10, 12 years, maybe more. I don't have that in front of me. But it was founded by CEO David Karp. And Lyle's got a Tumblr account. I think you have several
sure.
Tumblr accounts, actually.
Yeah, I use a couple. Actually, I think the blog that we were using for a while for GeekSpeak is a Tumblr account. But my personal Tumblr account is just at one of my domain names, because they give you your own domain name. So it's microblog.lyle.troxell.com.
Well,
and Tumblr basically is a small form blog engine. We had a show a while ago about microblogging, and Tumblr's been around for a long time. It's, of course, a commercial industry company, but it does do small microblogs.
Yeah, and the company and their employees have been very vocal on a variety of social issues. Well, a reporter was piecing together the current state of what they are talking about on their blog and what the CEO has been talking about. And the one thing he's not been talking about this year, as we've gotten a new FCC
chairman? Sure.
Chairman, has been net neutrality. Now, Tumblr was sold many years ago to Yahoo. And since then,
a little bit of history, it was founded February 19th, 2007, so 10 years ago, and Yahoo purchased it in 2013, and then it was transferred or sold to Oath, or did Oath buy Yahoo? I'm not sure, maybe Yahoo renamed. I know that there's a new Yahoo name, so possibly that's what Oath is. But
oh, yeah, yes, I believe that's
true. Oh, it's
true.
A Verizon company. Oath
exactly.
Is a Verizon company. Okay.
So Tumblr had its home at Yahoo for a while. Now it's a part of Verizon, and that just completed the final hurdle and is official as of a couple weeks ago, I believe.
Okay.
Well, now that Tumblr is a part of Verizon, Verizon has never been a big proponent of net neutrality, and there has been no word from Tumblr or from David Karp about the current net neutrality discussion, which, of course, is not going in the same direction that it was going a couple years ago when we did finally get some rules in place that were supporting net neutrality. So if anybody's expecting the debate to go on in the same way it did a few years ago, I suggest you get out there and let your voice be known.
Huh. So David Karp hasn't made any comment about net neutrality since being a part of Verizon?
Yes. Yes, exactly. Well, that's only been a couple of weeks, but even in the lead up, of course, the process of one company, one corporation buying another can take quite a while. And he's no longer CEO of his own company. He's a member of a much larger organization.
That's pretty sad, I have to say.
I've got some follow-up news that will make us happier, maybe.
Oh, great. Follow-up it is.
Because I feel like there's a lot of bad news lately. Sometimes I just need to kind of bury my head in the sand like an ostrich. And I have found very few places on the internet to do that. As it turns out, there's a new podcast out there. Actually, there are two new podcasts. One is called Trump. I think it's called Trump Explains Con Law or something like that.
What's con law?
Constitutional law.
Ah.
It's a podcast that Roman Mars did. Do you know Roman Mars?
Sure. 99% Invisible, Roman Mars.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically decided, it's called What Trump Can Teach Us About Con Law. I listened to the first four episodes. They're all about 10, 15 minutes. They're pretty short. Basically, his neighbor is a constitutional law professor.
Oh, cool.
And so they had this idea that, hey, you know, why don't you come over to my house every week and we'll talk about Trump's latest tweet. and what questions it raises
about
constitutional law.
Okay, I'll definitely have to listen to this.
Yeah, so if Trump says so-called judge, he's raising into question the power of the judges, you know, and that's not really a thing that we've had to consider before with sitting presidents before. The other podcast I want to mention, LeVar Burton of Reading Rainbow has started a podcast.
Oh, wonderful.
Of Reading Rainbow. I love this.
Yeah. I resisted the urge to say of Star Trek because that's not as relevant. He did play Geordi LaForge in Star Trek, where he debuted in the first season as
a blind navigator.
The world's first blind navigator. Mm-hmm. He had an eyepiece, though, to help him see. But in any case, everybody knows him from Reading Rainbow. Everybody loves that man's voice. I'm so excited to listen to this podcast. Basically, it's called LeVar Burton Reads.
Oh, great. And
it's just him reading short stories from all genres with a little music, original sound design sprinkled on a little bit. I'm so excited.
Awesome.
So should I play this for my kids?
I think so. I mean, it's also made for adults. It's made for adults, but probably it's fine for kids too. I can't vouch for that, though.
Ben, can we remind people what LeVar Burton Reading sounds like, please?
Oh, sure. Hold on. Let me awkwardly turn my microphone.
Hi, I'm LeVar Burton, and my new podcast is LeVar Burton Reads.
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit.
Each episode had the long talons, which the boy knew sat in the claws and even along the elbows and toes, been unsheathed.
All right.
But he imagined
LeVar Burton's new podcast, like Reading Rainbow, but for adults. Awesome.
He's got such a good voice.
That's so good. Thanks, Ben. Two uplifting, fun things to listen to. Of course, constitutional law one's just going to be depressing. But, you know, that's...
Actually, it is surprisingly not as depressing as I thought it would be.
Good. All right. I will listen to both of those. Thank you so much.
Buffalo.
Brian, tell us about artificial intelligence.
It's been a while since we talked about how to program on the show. Well, here's a new way. How about using AI to generate all your UI in code?
What's UI?
So it's user...
asks the front-end web developer.
You asked such a simple question. It's user interface. So
the stuff that I see when I go on the web or when I open up an app or whatever.
Well, and about 90% of what Lyle does here at Netflix as well. So there was a study, and this was not meant to... become a complete ready-to-use system. But there was a study on how to use machine learning to generate code that would create the UI for your application based on just the drawings or just the layout that the designer would make. So this is a pretty normal process when people are making apps, is to have a wireframe layout of what the user interface is going to look like. And of course, this only represents the static version of it, but you can recognize what's a button and what's a text field and the many other common widgets.
You basically do a drawing in something like Photoshop that looks like what the app will look like at the end, maybe not final colors, kind of gives you all the elements. And so you're saying this AI analyzes that and generates what kind of code from it?
Well, it can generate both iOS, Android, and web UI code that can be used directly. Yeah, I know. I hear your
skepticism.
That's the word for it. So let's just back up a little bit. So the technique goes back to what we were talking on the last show about convolutional recurrent neural networks, basically feeding into it all of these samples of what the different UIs could be and code that matches what would represent that UI. And we're not talking about 100% here. We're talking about only around 70-some percent of the UI that's represented in the drawing can be represented in code based on this system. But the idea is that through using this, it could give lazy programmers, which, you know, we all are, a nice jump start on getting into the code that they need to generate. Anyways, it's the first time I've seen machine learning applied to generating the code of an app.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that I don't know, 6 months ago, Miles was saying, well, pretty soon we have so many plug-and-plays that software developers will be replaced by AI. I had a long discussion about it. And here it is, you know, coming along nicely.
Yeah.
Beat by beat.
And I'll bet that this works especially well. So as a UI developer, you find sometimes you need to build specific UI for components that act in certain ways or whatever, and it's maybe more niche code, not so much boilerplate, basic code. But a lot of the times you're doing the same stuff over and over again. So this is probably a technique that would work really well for that 70% that is pretty much just the same thing over and over again, you know, like maybe with some exceptions, but...
Yeah, especially if it's following all of the conventions of the platform that it's been made for.
Right, and presumably the neural net was trained on a bunch of examples that were, you know, representative of the basic classes of UI layout problems that you have to solve.
Since we're talking about UI and AI and analysis of visual representation with code, can you got a story that's kind of about that, right? QuickDraw?
Oh yeah, QuickDraw. Google made this game, and actually you can go to it at quickdraw.withgoogle.com.
I played that a while ago. I think we actually covered it on once on Geek.
Yeah.
I'll take a look.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is basically 15 million people played this game. Probably maybe unique, maybe not unique, maybe player sessions, and generated 50 million drawings. And these drawings are of things like anvils and apples and teddy bears and bracelets and brains and bread. And I'm just reading now. But just a ton of different things.
Importantly, people were asked to draw these items. And then, so it was like, you know, draw bread. And then people, a whole bunch of people drew bread. That was like kind of the training set, right? Okay.
Right.
And it ran for a while.
Exactly right. That's the training set. Because why do you want a bunch of people drawing bread, right? Like, just for funsies? I mean, I guess so. It was a fun enough game that 15 million people played it. But Google has now turned this into a project that lets you collaboratively draw with a neural network. So you start drawing, and it'll finish your drawing.
Yeah, and it's creepily good at it.
So you played this recently?
Yeah.
Well, this is not QuickDraw. Yeah, this is not QuickDraw. This is the neural network that was trained using the drawings collected from QuickDraw, which was released a couple months ago.
I was just curious. So the training set is the finished drawings that's going into the machine learning algorithm. What's fascinating to me is that I expect you could even get better accuracy if you could analyze the strokes and the order in which the strokes are made.
Yeah, definitely. So probably
I would say the data set would be the entire drawing experience because it is you know, like a vector thing where you're drawing and it's kind of
okay. So there's an order and there's a direction of stroke.
Yeah. So how good is it at replacing completing your drawing experience? Well, when I played with this and it was a while ago, I thought this was what it was doing is kind of it could finish for you.
I think that this one is relatively new, but I'm not certain of that. But I did try to go to the website, which is magenta.tensorflow.org/assets/sketchrnndrawing.demo/index.html, and I got, your connection is not private. Attackers may be trying to steal information. So they need to update their cert, which is a bummer because I'm not brave enough to go, you know, click advanced and all the hoops you have to get through to get past this dialogue because Chrome is basically trying to protect me. But the other thing I wanted to point out is if you are listening to the show and you are a developer, all of this data is open. You can go and download this data. It's up on GitHub. So you can pull it down. They've got documentation on how to access and use the data set. They've got examples. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and since we got off the topic of machine learning for the AI, I'm sorry, machine learning for the UI, that is also up on GitHub called Pix to Code.
Very cool.
Pix to Code and QuickDraw dataset up on GitHub.
And of course, all that will be available at geekspeak.org on today's show, which is 7/7/2017.
Lucky, lucky show.
I'm just going to say that last week, or a couple times recently, this topic has come up, and we haven't actually explained it. Would you please tell me about not even wrong, Brian?
Okay. So first of all, there's a gentleman named Benedict Evans. He works for Andreessen Horowitz, which is a well-known VC firm. He's been writing articles for a while, but he wrote this one article that really caught my eye. And it's about this whole idea that in science, you have a falsifiable prediction. You have some way to determine whether this thing that you're, this idea that you're exploring is provably true or provably false.
So if I have a hypothesis, it's not a hypothesis unless there's a way to prove true or false.
Right, right. If you can conceive of a theoretical way to prove this, of course.
Or it's not a good hypothesis.
Well, it's not testable. And if it's not testable, right. It's not science.
Right, right, right. Which is actually one of the criticisms of string theory. Is like, you can't test that.
Well, he wanted to apply this in some way to futurists, to trying to figure out whether a technology is possibly going to be something that's going to explode and become really important in the world, or whether it's something that could linger for a very long time and never...
Like jetpacks or flying cars.
Well, yeah. Jetpacks is actually one of his examples. He starts off with two different technologies that I think we're all pretty familiar with. One is airplanes and one is cell phones. So both of these have an interesting history for proving his point. Airplanes, when the Wright brothers first flew in 1903... he outlines how there was this breakthrough of flight, but there was a traceable path that you could see that it could get improved and improved and relatively quickly become something that's going to be truly useful and truly impactful in the world. So there was this theoretical breakthrough, and then there was very shortly after that, about 6 years, there was somebody flying across the English Channel, very long distance for, for a flight at the time. And then you could see moving from wood and fabric planes up to aluminum planes to get something stronger that was still light. And then probably the biggest technological advance that was needed to really propel that forward would be jet engines. But that was just an additional technology that was needed. It wasn't a massively different technology needed.
So like you could imagine being back in that era before jet engines existed, and you've got these planes and you think, okay, if we could just come up with something more powerful, then we could go further.
Exactly.
Not too crazy of a jump. You don't know how to make a jet engine, but you can foresee that jump.
But you can definitely see like, well, the propulsion system we have, which is spinning blades, could probably be improved upon. Let's figure out how to do that. And jet engines can emerge from that.
Okay. Just a matter of weight versus propulsion to be able to use the basic principles you already know.
Or maybe rocketry might work. But, I mean, if you thought that, you'd be wrong. But, I mean, it's...
Now the Germans did it.
It's a... Yeah, that's true. that is true.
Not so much landing. But
right. Need SpaceX to do that.
Yeah.
But then there's the cell phone technology. There's car phones. Car phones, did you know they first appeared in 1940?
Car phones?
Wow. No, I didn't know 1940.
The first car phone, there's a picture of it here. It filled up the entire back half of this vehicle, but it was enough instrumentation, enough power to transmit a signal that could be reached by someone else.
I don't know if I'd call that a cell phone, though, because it probably didn't have cell sites.
What's
probably didn't
car
have multiple sites.
Phone.
Car phone. Okay.
Car phone.
But even a car phone, what's the difference between a car phone and a radio?
Well, in this case, there wasn't a difference.
Shortwave radio is not a phone.
Yeah, it's a mobile transmitter.
Yeah. So it's, I don't know. But anyway.
I'm just taking the air out of the story. But
but go on. Okay. So a mobile phone 1940 or car phone 1940.
But here, somebody had conceived and built the technology for a car phone, but it was not a clear path from this massive thing that filled up this vehicle to the point where we're all carrying around cell phones in our pockets, and certainly not once you start getting to the smartphone revolution.
Right. What you're saying is that thing that was transmitting in a car in 1940 did not have a step process to what we have in our pockets.
Yeah, there was no roadmap that could be traced.
Different. Okay.
Now, the interesting thing is, I don't have her name right here in front of me, but the whole idea of a multiplex cell transmission service was actually already conceived of and invented by...
What time frame?
She was the actress that was also a scientist.
Oh, yes. Oh, I remember this.
So that was already conceived, but still, that was not a part of...
Hedy Lamarr.
Hedy Lamarr. That was not a part of this story until much later. It wasn't until the 70s in which there was enough breakthroughs where you could start pairing together a phone number, a microphone, and a speaker and see that there was a path for this technology to become something useful and impactful on society.
Mm-hmm.
So with these two examples, he's trying to trace out his way of looking at a new technology. Maybe it's AI or machine learning. Maybe it's voice assistants. Maybe it's rocket packs. And trying to figure out, is this going to be something impactful? So rocket packs, we have the example of that in, what, the 60 years since we've known about it, it has only improved from about 21 seconds to flight to 30 seconds of flight. Wow. There's some basic physical limitations there that nobody's figured out a way around. And now we have things like Siri and Google Assistant and Alexa all sitting there trying to serve us. And his opinion is that he does not see that roadmap for where is that going to progress to the point where it's going to be as useful as we envision it, as impactful as it could be. This isn't exactly a scientific theory that he's laid out. I think there's still plenty of holes in it, but I thought it was a pretty useful framework to start looking at things. In fact, we've got stories later that we could probably apply it to.
I read a book this weekend about this, and although I wouldn't recommend the book, it was definitely bringing up a similar thing where you've got these stepping stones of different discoveries, and some are prerequisites for others. And it's not necessary. Sometimes you can see the path that you need to follow to get to a certain point, and sometimes you can't necessarily.
Yeah. So one of the example conversations he gives that he's trying to avoid is, well, that looks like a toy. Well, everything looks like a toy. No one wants that. No one wanted phones either. Both of these sides of the argument really don't inform us on whether some technology is going to go anywhere or whether it's not. You really have to start looking for those stepping stones, the path to somewhere.
By the way, you mentioned Hedy Lamarr. I was looking for the episode of Geekspeak that we talked about this because I know that we talked about it on Geekspeak, but I can't find it, which means maybe we didn't. Hedy Lamarr basically invented Spread Spectrum with another partner.
Spread Spectrum.
Spread Spectrum. Which is basically radio frequency hopping to send transmission. So multiple frequencies or frequency deviation kind of stuff. There's actually lots of ways to do radio.
Is this kind of like, and I'm going to talk about radio frequencies for a second as light because we can understand light a little bit better, visible light. Is that like saying you're flashing a red light versus an orange light versus a yellow light versus a green light, and you're flashing them at different rates in different ways, and you could set up a receiver on the other end to only look for that red light or only look for that orange light. And in that way, you're using the same open error space, this area that you're transmitting this signal across, but you're actually transmitting multiple of them because you're spreading them across different frequencies.
Yeah. Another way to think of this is when you play a whole chord of music, if you were thinking of like what's the original like boop, boop, boop,
Morse code.
So you could do Morse code with each of your keys of a keyboard, and all of them could be individual, or you could start with one frequency and go to another and jumping around. And radios tune to a specific frequency. That's how you use them normally. You traditionally used to use them. So you'd normally go like, C. I'm going to tune my radio to C, and you broadcast on C, and we're good. But instead, Hedy Lamarr and also a composer, George Athanol, developed guidance systems for torpedoes, which jumped around in that spectrum.
Interesting.
And used, I think, a radio to synchronize the jumping. So both you would use that radio to move your antenna around, and if multiple things were using that same frequency hopping, you could still be in sync and still transmit data and stuff. Really cool stuff.
Oh, interesting. So that is basically solving for the problem of I'm sending information to you on the note C, 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 and then Brian comes along, you know,
and just starts
polluting the la-la-la-la-la-la.
C, 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 C.
Right. So if you and I are jumping in a consistent way that we both understand around the piano, or in this case, around the radio spectrum,
yep,
then we could avoid that problem. And if we lose any data, we only lose a little bit of data because we're bouncing around so much.
Yeah, there's a bit of that as well. So anyway, two technologies, and we'll leave that at that.
That's really cool.
It's really cool. So, and it makes sense that musicians were doing that, of course. Because, yeah, but anyway.
So the final thing I want to talk about that Benedict Evans was talking about is a way to judge whether something's the right way to think about it for whether a technology is useful in the future. And that is the difference between subjective capability or subjective cases and the capability of whether it's objective.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. Well, let's back up. So when Edison created sound recording, what do you think he was thinking of? Was he thinking about music? Was he thinking about recording orchestras or the Beatles or
I don't know.
Pop music? No. He was thinking about sermons. He was thinking this
really?
Would be a really good thing for sermons so that all of these sermons of the preachers could get out to the public and would spread the word. That's what he thought the subjective use of this was. He wasn't objectively looking at what things would this allow.
Okay, so he had a purpose for it that wasn't about what it could be. It was about what he wanted.
Exactly.
Okay.
So you take away the narrative and you look at the actual capabilities of the thing you're evaluating.
So what does Benedict Evans say about this? I don't exactly understand how it connects.
And this is where I don't think his reasoning really holds up.
Okay.
In a great way, but if you can look for objectively what kind of powers does this give humans that we didn't have before, as he says, superpowers, and if you can define those and you can see a roadmap for those increasing, you might have a technology that really is going to go somewhere.
Here's a great – you and I have been talking a little bit on the side, Brian, about like what technology – so 8 years ago or something like that, maybe less than that. Everybody started having a phone in their pocket and an internet connection. And from that emerged Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat over different periods of time. All of these things that are, you need an internet connection all the time and having a camera is really useful. Right?
Yeah, ride sharing would not have been possible.
Ride sharing is another aspect without the camera, just about the internet connection. But this, and of course, GPS with ride sharing is one of the requirements for ride sharing.
And people who can't just have a dinner without pulling out their phone to fact check things.
That's true too. It's a very challenging thing to do.
Yeah.
So there's this idea that if you could think, well, the camera is not about like about taking pictures specifically. It's about or not about what you can do with the device right then, but that everybody has a camera on them leads to objectively other things like lots more pictures, the need to do backups and storage, like all these side effects of that emerging, including social networks.
Or the need to have something classify all those pictures.
Right. Anyway, that was very cool. I like the idea of thinking about the motivations of people, then also the side effects of those systems.
Yeah. But to take that camera idea a little bit further, when the camera was first on a smartphone or even on a feature phone, the idea was just pictures. But if you look pretty quickly, it started being used for other things. It started being used for barcode scanners or document scanning or all these other things as the capabilities of the image sensor became better.
Translation tools, discovering what an object is.
Right, and now you've got machine learning built into a device that can, on the fly, do classification of objects, and we'll talk about AR later.
Yeah.
Buffalo?
We're going to get into a discussion about something that's been haunting me lately and maybe help some people out with it, with burnout. You want to introduce this to us, Ben?
Yeah. So I actually, if you've been on Facebook recently, you will probably have seen this video that's celebrating Facebook having 2 billion people. And it has this kind of narrative of the number's not important necessarily, but it's about what we can do together. It's these animated characters that are all kind of forming this community, and it has all of your friends in it and everything. So I worked on that video, my team and I, and building something like that is... It's very, very involved,
mm-hmm.
Like 50 locales and all of that.
50 locations?
50 locales. So like Arabic.
Localizing.
Or, yeah. Localization.
Localization.
Yeah, sure.
So
and
a lot of stuff.
These videos are generated by a system that you work on.
Right. And so everybody who got a video, their video was distinct from someone else's.
You didn't make a video. You made a system that produces customized videos for every person that's going to get it.
A mind-boggling number of videos. Don't worry, I did not build each one of them. that would take probably 100,000 lifetimes to make that many manually. But in any case, launching a product, as you know, Brian, as you know, Lyle, it can be pretty intense, especially when you're getting near the end there. And everybody's kind of sprinting for the date, and then you make it, hopefully, fingers mm-hmm. crossed, and you launch.
You always seem to have deadlines too, right?
Yeah, there are always deadlines. In this case, our deadline was when Facebook reaches 2 billion, we want to launch. But so ideally, when you work that hard, you also have some recovery time. Because definitely in the last couple of months, I've been putting in more hours than I normally would put in, you know, more than 8 hours per day.
Which, you know, your attendance on GeekSpeak can result, you can show that a bit.
Yeah, that's true. I haven't really been around for a while. But when you do that too much, you get burned out, you know, you work too hard. And you're at least for me, my brain actually feels like it's been burnt out. Like I can't think as well. I'm less happy. And ultimately my productivity goes down. So like with something like burnout, it's not only in your best interest to mitigate it before it gets too far, but it's also in your employer's best interest. But it often doesn't work that way.
Well, do you think though that the ebb and flow of intense work like that produces some benefit for yourself and for the company? I mean, from your self perspective, at least you know where your cap is, where your boundary is, where you shouldn't go again. That's a good experience to learn, yeah.
Well, so to address that last thing you said, I think to an extent, because it requires some introspection. It's kind of, I mean, once you get burnt out, at least in my opinion, once you get burnt out, in my experience, I should say, once you get burnt out once, you can kind of identify that feeling as it's creeping on, but you can't necessarily identify it early enough for it to be meaningful for you to like dial back. Also, you might need to communicate with your manager and you know, plan for it and everything. Sorry, did that answer
your question? A little bit. Let me ask you something about this experience.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were at your limit prior to the launch?
I think I've gotten a lot better at this than I was before. So personally, I don't feel burnt out now. And
okay.
I don't feel like I was approaching burnout during this project. But I also had to be very careful about it. You know,
how did you prepare yourself to make sure that you didn't get that burnt out?
Actually, my manager and I have so every week I'll write down a scale of 1 to 10 of how happy I am and how burnt out I feel. Actually, the scale is anti-burnout, which is inverse burnout, and that way higher can be better and lower can be worse, right? So that's how I track it, and I'm in a pretty good space right now. But
I don't know how... if I fully understand burnout because
You said you were struggling with it a bit, or at least experiencing.
My experience, when you said burnout, I just translated it to my feeling of being overwhelmed, of having too many things to do, and therefore not achieving everything. And
is it just that though? Because you can become overwhelmed in a day if 5 people come to you with 5 different things, and now you're underwater and overwhelmed.
But yeah, and I would say the mark of burnout is how quickly you recover from that.
Yeah.
Mm.
How quickly can you rest? Come back to ability to actually think through the problems and perform at a high level.
Or, I guess I don't phrase it in that way. I think of it more like feeling like I'm failing at things because there's so much on my plate. So I don't know if it feels like a state that I get into. It feels more like a lot of things I'm dropping.
It feels like okay, so you know when you get too many things on your plate, pretty much for whatever you're doing, whether it's personal or hobbies or work, it reduces your ability to accomplish anything for any of the individual things because you're doing a lot more juggling, right?
And yes.
You've got more time that you're spent juggling. For me, it's the inertia of that, how quickly can I go from, oh, I've got too many things, okay, I need to like monofocus on this versus try and address all of them. I don't know. Is that? It's interesting. I feel like we went into the conversation thinking, okay, let's talk about burnout, but we should define the term.
I know. It seems like we all have different feelings. But have you been burnt out lately, Brian? I mean, you went through a major change in what you were doing in your life recently.
Okay. Yeah. So I've got a day job and I've got side projects as well. And I was working on a contract job that was scheduled for, I think we were talking about a month to a few months, and 18 months into it was going a long time.
Wow.
And this was during a course of my life that, of course, I've got kids. You can't predict what those activities will be months and months and months before, and then they expand. So, yeah, it was I was completely overloaded.
And this was a large-scale Swift iOS application development using core data. And so you have 18 years of high-intensity training.
18 months.
18 months,
yeah.
Excuse me. Well, 18 years of software development easily, but 18 months of focused on Swift, which is a programming language that's changed a lot in the last 18 months.
Well, yeah, it went through several conversions in just the 18 months of the project.
And, of course, Apple changes its APIs with core data. And, of course, you're also used iCloud for that service, for that system as well, right? So a lot of intense learning and working and deadlines.
Yeah. So, of course, as a side job, this is, I mean, this is happening on those hours that most people are I don't know, planning parties or reading books or enjoying TV. None of that was going on. So none of that downtime was happening. So mm-hmm. absolutely after those 18 months, the burnout was creeping in. And it really was a matter of I can't continue to think in a way that I know that I'm going to succeed.
Mm. I mean, does that feel familiar to you, Ben? This idea of like so much going on that you can't think correctly anymore?
Yes.
Okay.
But it's not just that there's so much going on that it's difficult to think. It's that it's there's a longer term feeling to it. Rather than feeling like, oh, there are a lot of things in this room I can't move around, it's almost like a slushier feeling. Like it's even if you were to remove everything from my plate, I wouldn't be like up and 100% ready to tackle whatever I have in front of me.
I think I might have gone so long without an understanding of what it's like to not have too much on my plate. I think I've had too much on my plate for the last 15 years. I don't think that I just do that. I just put stuff so much that it's all I'm always failing at something.
Well, okay, the failing at something, I don't see that as a mark specifically of burnout. Because certainly people who try a lot of things will fail at them. That's a good thing because you're trying a lot of things.
What does it feel like to be burned out?
unsure of your own abilities. I think that was one of the real marks for me.
That you started doubting yourself?
Well, not doubting myself, but doubting what I could achieve in a predictable time.
Mm-hmm.
Things that were just completely out of hand.
Ben, is that familiar to you too?
Yeah, somewhat. I've actually been Googling what is burnout? And I've come up with a whole bunch of these different articles, and every single one of them I look at, they talk about burnout, but none of them define it. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting.
I don't know if I experience it.
Well, you certainly don't sleep enough usually.
No, I don't sleep enough. And like, you know, I mean, the amount of stuff that I do, when I describe to other people, they're like blown away that I do those things.
Of course, we talked about that for years. But,
right, but it doesn't feel like – well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say everybody has different
thresholds.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for, has different thresholds of maybe activity mm-hmm. or the number of projects or whatnot. I can do a lot of hobby projects, and I do. And I can juggle a couple projects at work. But there's definitely a threshold where if I go beyond that, then – I spend a lot more work. I say caching to disk, which is a term for taking all of the stuff that's in the front of your mind and like having to put it away somewhere, maybe into a notebook, or if I don't have a notebook, it's even worse.
Now, one of the things that is not unique about you, but that I know about you is that you don't just do one thing for a long period of time. You're always jumping around from mm-hmm. podcasting to programming to woodworking to welding to all of these things. So perhaps maybe that's protecting you in some way from burnout because mm-hmm. I think you need that that consecutive working on the same thing a lot to really achieve the burnout that I know of.
You were kind of talking a second ago about the feeling of feeling like you're not sure if you can do something. And I definitely get into that space. And I call that depression. I don't call that burnout. And I know it's not clinical depression, but I do get to the point where I recognize in myself that everything I think I might be able to do, I feel like I would fail at and I wouldn't achieve it. And those are normally about a 6-hour window of time. And all I do is when I recognize I'm falling to that space, I just go, okay, it's time not to do anything and just relax and try to not do and not think about it. And because I know that I'll get out of that at some point down the line.
And that's healthy that you recognize that, right?
But so maybe that's just one of the methodologies I've come up with to get out of burnout quickly, if that's the same idea.
Yeah. So for me, I was getting to the point where I was taking time for myself and it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds very familiar.
Okay.
Yeah. It's this thing that sticks.
And I think about the big projects in my life, about how much work they do and the load. And then I think, maybe I'd change that. That would feel like a giant relief. Geek Speak's a great example of that, right? This is a lot of work to do this show. You know, I'm obviously good at doing it in the sense that we've been doing it for 17 years. But every once in a while I go, oh, if I didn't do that, what else could I do in my life? Hmm. And that definitely is probably a representation of feeling a little burned out, right? And
I feel like I've seen you be burned out on the show before.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know if you were experiencing the same things that I feel when I'm burned out, mm-hmm. but looking at the way that you talk about the show when you're in those periods, and it usually lasts for a couple of weeks. Maybe it's more mild and more long for you.
And I think that, you know, one of the things I'll do, and you'll probably see the episodes that are like that, I'll be less engaged in planning them and let it happen. The benefit of this program, of course, is that I get together really smart people and chat with them, and it's easy to do that, to have interesting conversations with smart, interesting people. But I think that that's a good good example of it, that I notice normally what I think of in those situations is there's an economics principle about this, opportunity cost.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And GeekSpeak has a large opportunity cost, right? Like you and I were talking about doing more Swift development. Like, I don't do Swift development at work because we haven't actually moved over to Swift as a full-time thing. But I know that in the next year, we'll be switching to Swift. So I really want to learn Swift, and you're this expert in Swift, and you and I like to hang out together. So we're thinking we'll spin up a project or spend some study time. And then I go, we could do GeekSpeak because that's how we see each other. So it's one of those things where instead of me investing in my future development experience and getting excited and spending time with you coding, I do the radio show, which has its benefits as well.
Actually, go ahead, Brian.
No, I was just going to say it's amazing to talk about this with you because I'm looking back at your history and you really do have these ways of releasing releasing the burnout, diffusing the burnout in yourself. And I respect that. I could never do what you do. I could never sustain it the way you have.
I think big change helps. You know, when I was at the university for years, I had all these projects to do for the university, all these different things that I'd decided to initiate and work on and develop. And when I left the university, I went, oh, those things are all gone. And I just left a property, like actually 2 days ago, on the first, I stopped being responsible for a 20-acre piece of land with multiple houses where I was the plumber and the roof repairer and took down trees and you name it, water system recovery. And all of that last night, I just kind of went, oh, that's it. I vacuumed a room and said goodbye to my neighbors. And it was like, oh, wow. I don't have to develop this piece of software I've been thinking about developing to manage meter reading systems. And so I think part of it is to take the joy in letting things go at some level. I'm not very good at normally doing that, though.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's a personality thing, and I'm terrible at that.
I then went home and set up a washer and dryer and hooked them up, of course.
Of course. There's this thing that happens to me that actually feels similar to burnout in a way, and I'm not sure that this is going to be any more portable than, like, knowledge that's portable than what we were talking about. But I have this thing with my eyes where I have a certain kind of light sensitivity, and it's not so much the amount of light that's hitting my retina, but it's if a lot of light is concentrated in a small area of my visual field, then it'll give me migraines. So, for example, if I'm in a dim room and there's a candle across the room,
or a reflection off a car outside,
see the flame, or a reflection off cars. These are like pinpoints of light. That's a lot of light in this very, very small area, and that will give me migraines. And I think what's also related to this is when I'm working on the computer, sometimes I get this feeling of dizziness if I look at the screen too long.
Mm-hmm.
And that feeling of dizziness feels very much like burnout in a sense. So as soon as
I have a real visceral feeling of it, that's
cool. I do. As soon as I feel it coming on, no matter where I am, whether I'm recording an episode of Geek Speak, whether I'm at work being productive, if I feel like I'm looking at the screen and I feel in my head, or I don't know what part of my body I feel it, but I feel this dizziness coming on, I know I need to stop looking at a screen right now. Because historically, if I don't respond that way, then the dizziness, it's almost like it sets in and then it stays.
Like
and
getting motion sickness where you can't, once it's happened, you can't get rid of it.
Yeah, if you're on a bus and you start getting car sick, well, maybe it's a little bit too late, because then no matter what you do, you can't, you know, shake that feeling.
There is
it's
that moment right before that, though, that you can catch it if you're conscious of it. Yeah,
if you're really conscious of it. But I mean, like, gosh, sometimes I just want to finish writing this stupid function and like I do it. But then I'm dizzy for the next day and a half, and that's really bad for my work.
Well, that long.
Yeah, no, it can last for weeks if I'm not careful about it. The same thing happens with burnout for me. If I don't catch it, then it completely cripples my ability to get things done. Hmm. And so I've learned to catch it as soon as I can. Does that feel at all?
I like that.
Like it resonates to you, Lyle?
Not exactly. I can totally understand that feeling. The motion sickness did seem to connect, but I get the what you're saying. What I think is fascinating about it is that we have this great word burnout. We're trying to kind of figure out where it falls into our lives and stuff. But one of the things that it feels like is a physical thing that occurs. And what you're describing is very much a physical thing. Like your body is engaged in a space where this is not an intellectual thing. This is not a only mental stress. This is a representation of your physical being needing something. That's a neat way of thinking about it.
It feels like it can be, and it may actually be just an intellectual thing. The dizziness thing is not actually related to burnout, except that it's similar in that if I don't catch it right away, then it cripples my ability to do things.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know.
Brian, what about you? Do you have a physical reaction to burnout? No?
No, not a physical. No physical manifestation of it. But I was realizing one of the other elements that we hadn't talked about was, one of the key things about, I think, all of us is we do things in our work, in our private life, that we are really engaged in, we love. We would think about them outside of whatever the task is that we're doing. In fact, with programming, I think that's essential. You have to step away and go take a walk, take a shower, whatever, and you figure the problem out that way. But when I'm burnt out, when I get to that place, I literally don't want to think about it anymore. I'm losing my interest, or I can feel that interest in dealing with that problem is going away. And that's a big key sign for me.
Mm-hmm. I was just listening to a podcast, and I wish I could recall what it was, but the conversation was about judges and paroling people. Did I tell you about this already, Brian?
No.
And I think that the numbers are accurate. And it was probably like, it was one of the big podcasts that are awesome. In any case, the general concept is that a study was done about judges and parolees. These are people that are in prison that might have parole, and they get reviewed by a judge, and the judge makes a decision. So not a panel, but a judge decision. And the best way to predict what would occur was to look at when the judge had eaten.
Lunchtime. You want to be after lunch.
You want to be right after lunch. When the judges were fed, 60% of people got parole. When it was right before lunch, almost zero got parole.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
So it is not an intellectual thought. It is a biological introduction thought. Mm-hmm. And I know that. I mean, you know that feeling of what's hangry? Where you're hungry and angry? Yeah.
I say grungry because I don't get angry. I get grumpy.
Yeah, that's good.
So
okay.
Grungry.
Yeah,
but grungry feels like a weird word.
Yeah. Hangry seems pretty appropriate. But I sometimes get angry when I'm hungry. Any case, that this idea that our biology defines a lot about what we actually are, and whether in the question comes about whether we really even have free will, and are we just a representation of where our body
stays.
Do we
want to go there, Lyle? Because we should start a new episode.
Okay. Next time on Geek Speak, free will.
Oh, no one's
but let's talk about. So, are we good with the finishing burnout?
I really want to be done with burnout. Yes, I very much want to be done with burnout.
Love to hear. Do you have feelings of burnout, and how do you cope with them in your life, and how do you figure that out? And have you gotten to a point in your life where you don't get to the point of burnout? Are you kind of wh- who who in this conversation do you seem to connect with more, Ben, Brian, or Lyle?
Or none of us.
Or none of us. Have a different opinion. Email us. We're geeks@geekspeak.org.
And if you would be so kind, define burnout in your email.
Ooh, good.
Yeah.
We'll take some snippets and use them next week. All right. Let's go ahead and talk towards the end of this show about
Buffalo
augmented reality and what Apple's doing.
Okay. Think back to our discussion about whether technology is going to go somewhere or not, and as we talk about this. So there's been a lot of articles about Apple's new AR kit, which was announced at WWDC. Thankfully, because the rules have changed in recent years, we can actually talk about some of the technology before it gets released in iOS 11 and Mac OS High Sierra this fall. Virtual reality and augmented reality have been around for a long time. I remember going to SIGGRAPH in 1993.
And seeing virtual reality?
Yeah, and seeing it out there. But we're getting to the point now where it can be handheld, of course. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this with virtual reality and things like Cardboard or the Vive or any of these other things that allow you to wear a headset and be immersed in an entire world that you can't see out of. But of course, AR is the world where you're putting this digital layer on top of or within the real world. And right now, the way this is manifesting itself is with your phone being able to take a look at the image from the camera and then add something to it. Or maybe you're labeling the objects that are there. Or maybe you're putting a computer graphics object inside the scene.
Or as simple as something like Snapchat, where you're adding glasses or funny bunny ears to your face in real time and kind of taking a picture of that. That's also augmented.
Yeah, all those apps, they're calling those filters, but what you're getting is augmented reality.
Yeah, the reality filtered.
Yeah, exactly. It was interesting because I didn't know what was going on in the Android world, but of course, Google has had their own augmented reality system out there. But there's only a couple devices that actually are built and able to use it. That system is called Google Tango. One by...
And Tango is basically a spec that Google's announced or said, play to the spec and you can do the AR stuff that we're providing in our operating system and such. And then a couple of vendors have actually done that.
Yeah. So there's the Lenovo Fab and the Asus Zenfone. These are devices that are able to use Google's Project Tango. Apple's system is going to be a big step forward in the sense that there's going to be millions of devices out there already on day one that are going to be able to use this. So any of Apple's iPhones that have the A9 or A10 chip will be able to use this system. So what can it do? While looking at the scene, it can find flat surfaces and figure out where spatially they are to the phone. And once you can do that, you can take something like a teacup and you can put it on the real table, so a virtual teacup on the real table.
Meaning that the phone shows a teacup, but it locks the teacup's position based off of where the picture of the tabletop is on the phone.
Right.
And as you move the phone around, the tabletop stays still, and so does the teacup that's actually in your phone being rendered. It locks also at the table.
So think about what it has to know to do that. It has to know the distance from the camera.
The angle.
The angle. It has to be able to calculate this and track it as you move the phone around.
Yep.
Because if there's any latency to that, any delay to that, it's going to look like it's sliding all around the surface.
Right.
So the real question is, what are people going to use this for? What are the apps that are going to come out once this is a common thing? And there's a site out there.
Pokemon Go is going to be better.
Yeah, actually, that's exactly it. Pokemon Go is finally going to actually stick things to the surface. But there's a site out there that's cataloging all of the tests that people are doing with ARKit, and I thought it was really fun.
Is this made with ARKit?
Made with ARKit. So on there are tests that show people making a door, which is a portal to another world. So in other words, you hold the camera up, and you're looking in the real-world scene, and you see a door, and through that door is another world. And as you walk through it, keeping looking at your phone, you step through it, and then you're in that world. Everything on your phone is that other world.
But that's cool.
But of course... your own reality hasn't changed. But there's other ones that actually start to get useful that kind of excited my imagination that I wanted to talk about. Like, What can you really do when you're holding your device? This isn't goggles on you. Right. You're not completely taking over your vision with this augmented reality. You're simply looking through the phone. So where is the usefulness of that? During WWDC, their big thing was they showed a game that used this. Well, imagine you're trying to order something from a restaurant, and you have no idea what the proportions are. I do this all the time where I look over at other people's tables to try to determine how big that plate of food actually is. Because can I share that with my wife? Or is this going to fill me up? Mm-hmm. Those are always the questions I have. Well, as soon as you can see your meal that you're about to order through AR, you have an innate sense of the spatial, the world around you spatially. Mm-hmm. And if you look through your phone and you can match that up with a virtual plate of food, you get an instant understanding of the proportions.
Right. So instead of just having that 2D representation of flat picture, you have this thing that kind of allows your body to experience it in the normal way.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
And there's other tests. Like there's one I saw where it simulated a Apollo lander going down on the moon. But what's cool about it, we only ever see films of that. Imagine if you're in a room where the moon is the size of a large table, and you can see the lander floating down to the surface of that moon. It's animating. It's like you're a witness, but you can move around wherever you want to. You have a much better understanding of the size of that lander and the size of the moon, which is
itty bitty.
It's a lot smaller than you think.
I think it's interesting. I mean, as somebody that has lots of experience with 3D from your film time at Pixar and such. The idea of having a 3D rendered world and looking at it and exploring it and understanding it from that perspective has a lot of power to it. And so being able to do that with digital objects made a lot of sense. I regularly, when I'm working on like a wood project or something, I'll go ahead and write it up and, you know, render it in SketchUp. I'll create a drawing of it in SketchUp. Not always perfectly to scale, but enough such that my mind can comprehend exactly what it would work. Or I'll take a room and throw the dimensions of a room and then inside SketchUp, sketch up the object so I can move around it, go, oh yeah, it would feel okay to have this piece of this project be this scale. So it's kind of like a sketch on paper, but allows me to move around three-dimensionally. It's a very powerful way to comprehend what's going to be produced.
Yeah, when I did projects and used SketchUp to plan them and to visualize them, it was still hard to really get a spatial understanding of, like, one time I made a bunk bed that was trying to fit into a very small room. Very, very narrow tolerances between where the door could swing open and where the ladder had to go and things like that. And even with all of my years of doing computer graphics, I only had so much understanding of that. But I can imagine doing this, you would get a much more instant understanding of the spatial reality.
Definitely. And one more, AR, Airbnb.
So you've got to take a look at this video so you can see how somebody's visualizing using Airbnb or using AR for Airbnb. Because imagine you go into a place you've never been before and you don't know where the thermostat is, where the fire extinguisher is, or how to use something on the washing machine. Imagine if somebody did a walkthrough with AR that showed you all of these things and all you had to do is put up your phone and all of a sudden you're seeing how to handle each device.
And Ben, tell me what you're going to be reading this week.
What I'm going to be reading this week, I'm going to be reading a book called Salt, Fat, Acid, and Heat. And in the post show, I'll talk more about it.
But what is it in general? Cookbook?
It's a cookbook, but more it's a book for understanding cooking, philosophies, frameworks. It's a really interesting way to change your thinking about cooking.
Awesome. I look forward to hearing about it.
A lot of good pictures.
GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so use our stuff any way you'd like. Just give us some credit. GeekSpeak is registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. You are listening to KBCZ 90.1 FM, Boulder Creek Community Radio. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell, and this is the ending of episode 24 of season 17. AIs get burned out on AR. Thanks, Greg Merkley, for that title. And thanks also to Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for the theme song. Ben Jaffe and Brian Young, thank you so much for joining me on episode 24 of season 17 of GeekSpeak.
Thank you, Lyle.
It's awesome. I'm not burnt out.
Post show.
Okay, I got to finish one last thing. Everybody's going to get an AR app in the fall that will be able to measure the distances of things just by looking at one spot, marking it on your phone and then moving your camera to another spot.
Is Apple doing that?
No, no. It's just that that was the first thing everybody came up with. There's been a bazillion tests of these. And the funny thing is you're going to have this $800 phone that you're going to use to measure distances. And it's going to be off by about a half an inch over 30 inches.
Yeah, wow. It's not something that's useful. I mean,
But hey, yeah, you can measure a tree.
I'll tell you, actually, it is useful because every time I go to Home Depot, I remember I don't know how long my fingers are. And so I have to like find a 2x4, figure, okay, that's 3.5 inches. You know? Okay, so then how long is my pointer finger? Okay, it's about this long. And that means that this is like 4 of my pointer fingers. Okay, so this is probably 12 feet. That this is about 12 inches or whatever.
And that's probably as accurate.
So yeah, at Home Depot, they almost always have, or any of these big box stores, they almost always have a display unit of measuring tapes. When I go to the store, if I don't have one on me, I take one of those and use it while
in the store.
No, they're all over the place.
I gotta go walk.
You just carry it around, and then when you're finally leaving, you place it, put it back down. But actually, normally, I just on the weekends, I'm like wearing a tape. That's what you do. You wear a tape.
That's what you do. You wear it. I'm just doing this wrong.
You just grab a tape and put it on your hip. You feel all cool.
Yeah.
No.
No, I don't feel cool.
Buffalo.
Okay, tell us more about this book.
I love this book. I have not read the full thing. Once I read the full thing, I'll give it maybe a more in-depth review.
Why do you love it?
So just opening it up, you can see that the author has not only put a lot of thought into this, but is really kind of presenting this with the beginner's mind in mind. You know, I am a beginner to cooking. I really don't know what I'm doing in the kitchen. And I feel like this book is approachable. So I want to just take you through a couple pages that I found particularly interesting. Just paging through this a couple minutes ago.
Before you do, approachable for a computer engineer or approachable for just somebody that thinks like you?
I think approachable for anybody. Like there are a lot of pictures. You know, so I might look at the picture and be like, oh, okay, this is about a third and, you know, whatever. But maybe somebody might just look at it and think of it more spatially or whatnot. But yeah, I just
all right, go through a page.
So what happens when you oversalt things? What do you do? So he kind of outlines. So for me, I think, okay, I way oversalted this. I give up. Like, there's probably some way to fix it. Put a potato in it. Like, I don't know.
I recently oversalted my eggs because I messed up. I was tired and just oversalted my morning eggs. And so I added sour cream. Would that help?
I don't know. I'm not a cook. But I do know
tastes
that the way that he the couple of paragraphs, one is dilute. So increase the volume of the dish, you know.
So you've made three eggs? Make 20 eggs.
So that's maybe not the best option. Or another thing is half it. So take your three eggs and cut it in half or cut it in thirds and then use that one, right? Eggs is a bad example, but if you make soup or something, you know.
But it, in some ways it kind of makes sense in the sense that, well, you were planning on having like three eggs, but you oversalted it.
Eggs have a granularity. No, so halving would be take your huge pot of soup and put half of it away, and you can use that as a salty base for something in the future, and then take the half of the soup that you have now and you can add more ingredients to it.
That makes sense, sure.
And that's that way you don't get like five pots of soup. Another thing you could do is you can balance it. So sometimes things that seem way too salty just need a little bit of acid or something like that. I feel like that's way too expert for me. So I probably wouldn't go that direction. But he does have some information about things that you could try. Another thing is maybe if your dish is too salty, maybe an element of it is too salty. So if you're making beans and the beans are sitting in some broth, maybe you could throw away the broth or you could throw away the bean. Not throw away, but put it aside or dilute it or something like that. And maybe the beans and the soup are totally fine. And your broth is just the thing that's way too salty.
I learned something recently about salt and
what's that?
Food. Take hamburgers, and most people will salt their burger meat. You do not want to salt the burger meat before you mix the burger. Because what salt will do is actually break down the material inside the cells, drawing stuff out, and actually produce a more rubbery type of substance when it hardens. A good example of this is the texture of sausage. Sausage is a salted and mixed thing that then sets. That snappy and rubbery feeling of sausage, that's what that is. So what you want to do with burger meat is don't salt it beforehand and then salt it after the patties are made. And then when you cook them, you'll get kind of a springy outside, which will hold the shape and help with the shape. But the inside it will fall apart like a loose meat instead.
Got it. The other two bullets are transform. If you have oversalted meat, you can cut it up and mix it with some other things and change your dish to be a different dish, right? And then the last bullet, which has the most written about it, is admit defeat. And that's like a bunch of feel-good things, like never despair, mistakes, or, you know, like...
McDonald's is only three streets away. No, I'm just kidding.
That's true.
So, go ahead. I was just going to say, I've always been in awe of people that can cook without recipes, because I can cook anything as long as I've got a recipe in front of me. But this whole idea of just taking food that's in the fridge, combining it, and then eating it has always eluded me.
Well, you have to have a lot of leeway in what you think is good food. As long as you're very loose in that definition, it's easy to do. Well, that was always my tactic.
I was a college student too, but that's not the point.
No, I know the feeling. I'm married to somebody who can cook amazingly well, and she doesn't use recipes at all.
We got a couple more.
Okay.
Salads. You've got the wedge, the Caesar, the Cobb, and the Greek, and he breaks it down in this table by salt, fat, acid, crunch, and umami. And he lists out the things that give each one of these salads each of those elements. And that's why we like those salads so much.
Nice.
Right?
So all salads have those elements?
Those four salads have those elements.
I don't know if a Cobb is really a salad. Depends on how it's made. I've had Cobbs that are just like meat with lettuce under it.
Yeah, yeah.
I do like a Cobb, though.
This one is really cool. Actually, I'll ask you to describe this visually in a second because it's a big chart. But first, I'll also do doughs and patties. And he lists out – I've always thought of – doughs and batters, not patties, doughs and batters, you've got like brioche and donuts and sourdough bread and shortbread and puff pastry and pasta, right? And these different things are related in that they're made of doughs and batters, but there are these different textures, right? Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought that there would be a unified theory that could help me think about all of these things in the same universe. But the thing that he lays out is you've got four primary variables that determine texture. Go for it.
Okay. One is the holding together aspect, the gluten aspect of it, though it doesn't have to be gluten. One is the air amount in it. Then one is the flexibility of the material. And then I'm not sure what the last one is. Probably the moisture.
So think of it – or try again, but in this different way. What are the things that you would put into it?
Okay, well, so for adding the air, you can either do something that's live like yeast, or you can do a baking soda / baking powder.
Okay, so you got one of them.
And that will cause reaction. Yeast would be one of them. Baking powder would be an opposite of those. And then, of course, you're going to have flours, or the binding agent is another way to describe that. And then the amount of the water. But I'm
water is one of them.
Yeah.
So he's got yeast.
Oh, and then, of course, the production of the glutinous strands, the amount you mush them or knead them.
Knead them, yes. Kneading, exactly. So the movement that you do. So you've got yeast, water, kneading, and fat.
Ah, fat, yes,
yeah.
Of course.
So you put these together and you look at something like shortbread or Mexican wedding cookies, which are my favorite. They're so good. Fat and kneading. Not so much water, not so much yeast. But you just take those two things and you get this crumbly feeling. Or if you want chewy, like sourdough bread, then you do kneading, water, and yeast, no fat, and you get that
cool
chewy texture.
Cool.
It's pretty fantastic.
I don't do any grains at all, so I'm just not
okay.
Eating those things.
Last thing I want to just hand you. Ooh, it's huge book over here.
All right, it's a very large disc that's actually two pages of the book. And it's three sections. There's a center area, an outside area, and even a larger area. And they look like regions. So in the very center, you have the continents or subcontinents. And then outside of that, you have islands and areas and countries of that. And then outside of that are the types of spices. Spices, yeah.
The types of spices.
This
so
is
if
really
you
cool.
want to do like Mediterranean, what's that?
Hand-drawn, by the way.
Hand-drawn. Oh, I thought you said, that's pretty cool, and wrong. I'm like,
wrong.
Wow, that was a quick judgment.
So if you're in it, can I just help the visual image here?
Yeah.
It's actually a dartboard with...
It's a dartboard, yeah.
What'd you say is on the center?
Continents. And then the next row is what?
Is the sub-countries, right?
Sub-country. And then you have the spices on the outside.
Mm-hmm. Right. So basically you say, okay, I want to do something in Asia. And then from that you say, I want to go Japan. And then from that you say, okay, well, here are the predominant spices of that area. So maybe I'll go pick some of those up at the supermarket, or maybe I'll mix them together.
And that's, of course, interesting is that the spices repeat all over the place. Like they're not like oregano's
cumin,
a lot of places.
Oregano everywhere, but...
It's oregano all the way down.
So Thailand, Thai basil, chilies, cilantro, coriander, cumin, curry, paste, ginger, lemongrass, mint, turmeric, kaffir. I don't know what kaffir is. Is that the milk?
K-E-F-E-R?
K-A-F-F-I-R.
Kaffir.
It's not kaffir lime. And
Oh, yeah. It's a specific kind of lime. I actually used to have one.
Oh, cool. As a plant?
Yeah, as a plant.
And you lost that plant?
I did.
So that
Wait, where did that? Oh, yeah, that stayed at my old house, I think. Mm. Yeah. It's tasty.
This is a cool dish. I mean, this is a very cool chart because you really could just go, I want to eat French food. Let's see whether,
yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. And like, I have no idea how to cook French food, but at least this gives me a starting point for my spices.
Lots of fat.
Lots of fat.
And these
baguettes
these
and
things.
Everything.
No fat in baguettes.
You just anyway.
You put fat on the baguette afterwards, the butter.
Mm. Yeah, of course. I know that. I mean, I don't know much, but I know that.
Oh, we got into food post-Geek Speak episode.
Seriously,
this
book is awesome. And I should probably have read it before offering a review, but I will read it and I will report back.
So from my years of radio experience, something that is a pet peeve of mine on podcasts, people mention it. The item they're talking about, and then they talk about it for a long time, and they
and
don't
they never
mention
say
the
name
end.
At the. So let's so just ben, let's just carry on.
Ben, what is that book?
Salt, Fat, Acid, and Heat by Samin Nosrat, and the art in it. There's a ton of amazing art in it by Wendy McNaughton.
Awesome, thank you.
Big book. Also, actually, I think it's being featured in a lot of bookstores right now. It's relatively new, so if you go to the local bookstore, maybe.
It's mostly white. It's hardbound currently. And it's got pictures of food on the outside.
Imagine that. Mm.
Rigetti Computing, Brian?
That sounds like a pasta.
It does. I totally feel like it. I must be hungry now. With oregano.
You're hungry for some quantum computing, apparently. So this is perfect after-show fodder, because this is wandering into the area which we know nothing about.
But really?
I know
really a little
nothing.
Bit about
no,
quantum
no, no.
theory.
No, but the thing is, I can tell that you know nothing because the more you learn about quantum physics, the more you know nothing.
Unless you are really good with math, in which case you can know a lot about it.
Okay.
Anyways.
I'm just saying, don't trust this man over here.
Don't trust his certainty?
Yeah, exactly. Always doubt certainty. Be suspicious of certainty.
Especially location.
Especially people who are certain about other people's incompetence. Doubt them. Yeah, doubt me. Anyway.
Well, Miles always says about quantum theory, the more you learn, the stupider you get.
Oh, yeah. I definitely agree with that.
All right.
Or we stupefy us.
And the more paranoid you get. Oh, my God.
Or we can also say that Lyle both knows everything about quantum computing and nothing, and we just have to keep going to find out.
That's right.
No, I'm pretty sure he knows.
No, I have a qubit of knowledge about quantum computing. When I dropped out of middle school in seventh grade, I just couldn't stand middle school. It sucked. I decided to do homeschooling.
Wait, you're a middle school dropout?
I'm a middle school dropout. And so I told my parents I hated it, and they said, well, you got to keep on doing theater, because I was doing theater at the time. And then
your parents are cool.
Yeah. And now you also have to do like math, science, and English. So I hated the English. I've always had difficulty with the word stuff. But my math teacher actually became my electronics teacher, who is a world-renowned quantum physicist. And so his name is Nick Herbert, and he's a Boulder Creek resident actually, and a good friend of mine. And he taught me about electronics and – you know, I've read his book on quantum theory and talked a lot about Schrodinger's cat, so I can get confused about quantum theory just like you.
Well, maybe you can teach me a few things here.
Why not?
So this pasta of a company, you guys totally messed me up.
Rigetti Computing.
Rigetti Computing.
Andreas and Horowitz.
They are one of the startups in the quantum space. They have built a number of things.
including a fab for building quantum computers. They've built a language for quantum computing, and they have built a cloud service that allows you to do a 30-qubit quantum simulation. It's not actually a quantum computer with 30 qubits.
No, it isn't. Not yet.
But what they're building here is a combo device, a classical quantum combination computer.
Oh, cool. So, this is like a hybrid car, but with computers.
Yeah, and the quantum physics. And the idea is that quantum computing is good for a certain class of problems, sure, and that classical computing is good for everything we know how to do right now. And so the attempt here is to create a shared memory space that these two different computing paradigms — is that actually the right use for that? These two different computing paradigms can read and modify the shared memory. And they have a language that you can use, and you can sign up for this service. I am in the early stages of signing up to see what it is like. But as I start to read through this, I feel like I am entirely a child with computers again. It feels like I'm back at 8 years old, because none of these terms make any sense to me yet.
It's awesome. It's like it's what other people think about what we do.
So you're starting over.
It is starting over.
They're completely different algorithms, like different concepts of algorithms. Like, quantum computing is a completely different field.
Well, there's a Weird Al song which feels appropriate. It's called "Everything You Know Is Wrong."
Can you sing it?
No.
Oh, come on.
No.
You're just teasing us now.
I think some of the lyrics are "Everything You Know Is Wrong," but that's all I remember about it. I think I last listened to this song when I was 8 or something.
Which is when Weird Al was really famous.
Yeah.
So what I recommend is going to their site and taking a look at this video, because the video actually makes you feel like you're just about to understand a little bit about what a qubit can do for you. In this article, somebody's making the case that quantum computing has its own kind of Moore's Law, and that as quantum computers begin to actually become functional and add more qubits to their the device, they are going to very quickly ramp up to the point where they're going to, of course, blow away what a classical computer can do. And apparently that is once they reach about 128 qubits, they will be astronomically faster at a whole class of problems.
Currently, the RSA encryption algorithm is about integer factorization. We talked about private keys and public keys, and what those actually are two prime numbers, or one's a prime number and the other is the multiplication of that prime number into a second. And so even though I can give you my public key, you can't actually derive what the other prime number is from it, which is kind of amazing. And that's highly useful in mathematics. Quantum computing, you can actually highly parallelize high-speed integer factorization. And I think that's – how is it? Shor's algorithm. I can't remember if it's Peter Shor or some other Shor.
Howard Shor.
Howard Shor, yeah, exactly. I think it's Peter Shor. Did this in like the mid-90s, figured out an algorithm that used qubits to relatively quickly factorize large numbers. And so at some period of time in the future when we have quantum computing, the current algorithms we're using will be completely knowable, which is amazing. And there's actually just recently an article by Dan Bernstein about using RSA in a quantum world, a quantum computer world. And what you'd have to do is basically, I can't recall the exact size, you'd have to have a private key length of terabytes. And then you would make it inefficient unless you had thousands of qubits, which we won't have for a long time. So theoretically, we keep doing that. But actually, there's quantum computing safe algorithms that we can use with traditional computers that will assure security even in a quantum qubit world.
People have been working on that algorithm for a while.
Yeah, so we have methodologies to move into. We just need to do that. It's going to be a period next 10 years.
Okay, I want to talk about this because you said it's going to be a long time before we have a 1,000-qubit device. So this piece that I'm referring to, it's definitely marketing. This is definitely them hyping up this pasta company. But
Stop calling it that.
I'm sorry, it's stuck.
Bugatti.
It is interesting to use this chart to see if any of this comes true, because the Moore's Law he's referring to in this article is that every year the number of qubits that they'll be able to make a computer contain, a quantum computer to use, he believes it's going to go up every year. There would be a doubling of the qubits. If that were true, it's only about 10 years till that 1,000 qubits comes in.
That is a cool idea. Moore's Law has been very powerful in predicting transistor replication. But what you're
about... You know what? I am reading that wrong. I'm sorry. He is saying that's N years. I'm sorry.
He's not defining the duplication period.
Yeah, I was misreading that.
So the problem with quantum computing, though, is that you are producing a quantum state, a quantum entanglement state, if you will, larger and larger and larger. And so that's a physically very difficult thing to do, and we don't know how to do that yet.
Right.
So whether it's even possible to upscale, because at some point, if you have a quantum effect that is really large scale, you could theoretically have a cat that was alive and dead at the same time, and we don't think we can do that. So there definitely is a physical boundary of what is feasible in this. Currently, I don't know what that is.
Currently, until we invent quantum jet engines.
So
the other aspect is that in some ways we do live in a quantum computer. Like, you could think about the universe as that.
You're getting really philosophical,
but not,
man.
Not a mathematical quantum computer.
Well, if this company is going to be the one that makes the big breakthroughs on quantum computing, they have one thing in their back pocket that seems to be truly powerful, which
an Italian name,
which is that everybody loves pasta. No, it's that their fab that they built is built around this idea of quickly turning out new designs. They are able to produce a device using a new design within 2 weeks, where typically it's done in much, much, much slower processes. So I'm curious to see whether their iteration cycle is going to get to the point where we actually do get a real quantum computer here soon.
All right. Cool. Well, I mean, we do have quantum computers that just happen to have like 3 bits or less. So it's not exactly that easy to program. Well, we are running out of time to be here today, but I would like to invite both of you to cover your last stories if you'd like to do that. Buffalo.
Now you're getting into complete sentence territory.
What?
Yeah. What do you mean, what? Isn't it obvious? The sentence, buffalo.
What in the world are you talking about?
So, it turns out, and some of our listeners may be nodding their heads like, mm-hmm, yep, I know what he's talking about. Everyone else is like, what? Because I haven't primed your brains yet. So, turns out buffalo, the word buffalo, is a proper noun, verb.
A city, to push something.
I told you this last week. Don't pretend like you know. It's a proper noun, it's a verb, and it's a noun.
Wait, what noun is it?
Buffalo the noun refers to the animal, also known as a bison.
Oh, bison.
Buffalo the city, that's the proper noun. And buffalo the verb is to push someone, to buffalo, bully, harass, intimidate, to buffalo someone.
Okay, I have never heard that verb.
No.
Really.
When has that ever been in use?
I've heard buff.
Right now. So if you say bison, bully, that's true.
Sure.
If you say the equivalent of that using the word buffalo for both, you say buffalo, as in the animal, buffalo, like they push each other around, implying, you know, the I guess recipients.
And if you said buffalo. Los Gatos buffalo, you'd be talking about buffalo that live here in Los Gatos.
Yeah, Los Gatos buffalo.
Okay.
Like they push each other around. You can also say buffalo. So you would say the animal buffalo push around other buffalo animals.
And you
buffalo,
can also
buffalo,
say
buffalo.
You can also say the buffalo that came from the city of Buffalo, that live in Buffalo, the
buffalo,
city.
Buffalo.
Wait a second. Have you ever been to Buffalo? There are no buffalo in Buffalo.
There have to be buffalo
it's
in
probably
Buffalo.
Probably a zoo.
There's no buffalo
are
in
you,
Buffalo.
Are
it's
you
probably
buffaloing
a zoo.
Us?
So, The really cool thing about this is if you read the Wikipedia article, which is linked up on the show page, the Wikipedia article is called Buffalo, 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 Buffalo. But as it turns out, you can make a proper sentence out of any combination, any number of the word buffalo in the different meanings, as long as it's bigger than two. Because the word buffalo on its own is not a sentence. It's
right,
just
it's
a
either
word.
A verb or a noun or a proper noun.
Right. But you could say buffalo, buffalo, like the animal, verbs. You can say the proper noun, noun, verbs, like buffalo from buffalo, buffalo, each other. And then you can also say buffalo from buffalo, buffalo, other buffalo from buffalo, which buffalo, other buffalo from buffalo, which buffalo, other buffalo, which buffalo, other buffalo. So you can go on as much as you want. It's kind of like football, where you're like, where are you going with it? Where you
now,
can
they
score.
They do have football in Buffalo.
Where you can score any number of points so long as it's two or greater. You could score a safety. You could score what's that one, the kicking thing?
The kicking one. It's called a field goal.
Field goal. You could score a field goal.
You play sports ball, don't you, Ben?
Yeah, yeah. So I play sports ball. You could do two safeties is four. You could do a safety and a field goal is five. Two field goals is six, and then you get up to a touchdown
can
is
I,
six.
Can I also suggest something?
Yeah.
There's a type of fish called a buffalo. So in that sentence,
what?
You could have, yes, buffalo
no,
fish.
You're making this up.
No.
But can you say buffalo or do you have to say buffalo fish?
If you have a robe made from a buffalo skin, that robe can be called a buffalo.
Okay, so
and therefore, you could have buffaloed buffalo where they're robed buffalo. In fact, almost all buffalo, unless they're in a lot of pain,
but that
are
makes
buffaloed.
That makes me uncomfortable. But you are saying, basically you're saying that the following sentence is correct. Buffalo, 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 buffalo fish.
Yes! Except that's a very sad little fish, because all these mean buffalo are coming from buffalo.
Or they're buffaloing each other, and the last one is
one thing, I just looked up buffalo, because I want to know the definition.
Can we
and
stop
this
saying
is
this word?
It's yourdictionary.com, so I'm not sure if it's properness, but it's probably correct. Verb, to buffalo, is to confuse or deceive. It is not to push. Let's look this up on another dictionary source.
I just looked it up on, okay, hold on. What's the OS 10 dictionary?
That's Merriam-Webster?
I'm using New Oxford American Dictionary. Ah. Buffalo, a heavily built wild ox with back. Okay, that's not it. A large grayish olive freshwater fish, okay, with thick lips. You're right. It says, also, verb, overawe or intimidate. She didn't like being buffaloed. Or baffle someone.
But it's
the problem
not physical.
Has buffaloed the advertising
but
staff.
But it's not a physical shoving. It's an
oh,
emotional
right.
thing. So these have to be highly intimidating buffalo. How does a large buffalo or even a small buffalo from Buffalo confuse someone? When I'm editing this show, I'm just going to add buffalo throughout the entire thing. In the beginning of the show as well.
I do believe we have found a candidate for a virus in the English language.
Buffalo. There's an episode. There's a podcast I listen to regularly, and his call out is a sentence, and it's umpro dupro. Oh, man.
What? Umpro dum.
Oompa loompa?
No, it's Peru. Umpro duperu. Something else. In Peru, you can use Peru for three different meanings. I think one of them is phallic in nature. And I've got to look up the podcast now. You know, it's times like this when I realize that I'll spend more time editing than I want this week.
You
is
can
that,
just
is that
leave
feeling,
off the post show.
Is that burnout?
I've got one more thing about words.
Oh, can it be about buffaloes?
Yeah. It's not about buffaloes, no. It's about yoga. Just while we're talking about words, I just got to get this out of my brain.
So he's telling you, don't add this in the show.
Oh no, you can add it in the show. And actually, if you were hearing my voice right now, and this also bothers you, write into the show so I know I'm not alone. If it doesn't bother you, well, I hope I didn't ruin yoga for you. But when you go to yoga class, it feels like pretty much all the time the yoga instructor uses present participles, like all the time. So
define that term. I didn't
being
I didn't do well in my English class. I was paying attention to quantum physics.
Any verb that is in the ing form. So listening to your breath, taking a moment to blah, like.
Maybe this is just your yoga teacher.
No.
Really?
It's not. Okay. Every yoga class I've gone to, they always start their sentences with present participle, taking a moment to breathe. And my brain inserts a comma, like taking a moment to breathe, comma, listening to your breath, comma, and the entire class is an incredibly long run-on sentence. And it never ends. It never finishes. It never concludes.
I am thankful I am not inflicted with grammar.
And you should hand a bag of commas to your teacher.
Oh, my God. It bothers me so much.
But the thing is, there's I guess, an implied a subject that's you. Because so, it's not even a run-on sentence if there's no subject.
Exactly. I'm waiting for the subject, and the subject never comes, and I leave incredibly tense and dissatisfied.
At the very end of this class, you're like, the man breathed, or the man left the class.
Yes, exactly. It's actually, there's a perhaps apocryphal story of, I think it was Mozart or Bach or something, where somebody played a piece, and they played the second to last chord, which is a 5-7 chord, and that wants to go to a 1 chord to resolve the entire piece, and the person didn't play it as a joke. And like everyone had a laugh, and the person
you make the sounds for us? Can you hum a little bit of it?
Ba da bum bum bum. Imagine if it went ba da bum bum.
Oh God! It's or like how about a just comma.
Bum?
Or
yeah,
just shaving a.
Stop it! And so he had to go to his piano when he got home and play the resolving chord. But anyway, I have thought about this a lot, and I think the reason is that if you say, pay attention to your breath, that sounds a lot more direct. Maybe
right.
Maybe it might feel even a little bit aggressive, or like, don't tell me what to do for some people, or
It's a phrase of inviting. A phrase of inviting.
So it's an invitation.
The teacher could also say, I invite you to listen to your breath. Right.
Which is really funny you say that, because my very first yoga class was yesterday, and it was filled with exactly what you said, along with a few pleases in there.
Was this in Ben Lomond?
Yes.
That's a good teacher.
Yes, she is. Yeah.
So she didn't drive Ben crazy with
comma
inference.
No, you should come to Ben Lomond.
Present participles. Yeah. Yeah, I should.
Un Peru, du Peru, do Peru. Mike Pesca's The Gist, which is a great podcast about contemporary pop culture stuff. It's from The Slate. And so I'm reading a blog entry by Jeffrey Bohrer on Medium. The total assembly of the sentence took two of The Gist podcasts, the first about words that sound the same but can have multiple meanings. Homophone? Is that what it means?
Homophone.
Like the country Turkey and the turkey itself and buffalo, for example. Based on that podcast, a listener, fellow something, tweeted Mike with a Brazilian homophone, Peru, do Peru. Because in Brazil, Peru is the country, a turkey, and a penis. So a Peruvian turkey penis is a Peru, do Peru, do Peru. The last do is pronounced do, so un Peru, de Peru, du Peru.
How about Depardieu?
Which is a full sentence, which is kind of funny, because it's just the same word over, kind of like buffalo, buffalo, buffalo.
Yeah. Mm. Homophones are fun.
Can you say that in a different way?
Yeah.
We have one more story for today, because why the heck not? You're right. Words are cool. That was awesome.
Thank you for moving on, because I was thinking, like, what's another way? I can't think of another way to say that. But I do like saying, whenever I have to say redundant, I always say redundant and repetitive.
Yes. Very good.
Makes me so happy to say that every single time.
I love it. I love it. I love that. Love that.
Why?
repetitive.
That's not a homophone.
You should just end the show like that.
According to statistics.
When Brian lost his mind.
Brian has a final say on something that we've been deciding a long time. No, it's not Emacs and Vim.
We're finally off that subject.
We're finally off of Emacs and Vim. Miles isn't here to debate. So it's something else that programmers like to debate. What's the other thing that programmers like to debate? Ben?
Spaces and tabs.
Nicely done. Brian, go for it.
And I have a very strong opinion on this.
Oh, I want to hear the strong opinion before I say the story.
When you're writing software, you normally have to indent the language, especially a language like Python, which requires indenting. But other languages don't require indenting, though it's easier to read and understand if you have like an if statement and you have some stuff inside the if statement to put spaces or tabs in front of all the stuff that's in the if statement. So you can read it really easily. Some people think you should use the tab characters. Some people think you should use multiple spaces. Defend yourself. Ben.
Stake your claim.
Which one do you like?
Neither, actually. I think both. So
that's a cop-out.
No. Listen, I have a very specific opinion.
Don't buffalo him.
The tab exists to indent characters. It's a specific character made to do that, right?
It's for indenting.
It is for indenting. Therefore, one should use tabs. However, in some situations, you might want to take a particular line, let's say one very, very long line, and you want to break it up onto multiple lines. In that case, the second line, which would normally just be on the first line, but you've moved it down manually, should be indented beyond the original indentation of the line with spaces.
But not a complete second tab to denote another block. Gotcha.
Are you saying...
And the reason is that the tabs go up to the indentation level of whatever block you're in. Mm-hmm. So if you're inside of an if statement or inside of a function, you're one level deep, then your second line would normally, if you just hit enter, it would go two spaces or one tab in with my preference, one tab in. But if you wanted to go further in to indicate, hey, maybe this aligns with something. Maybe I've got a bunch of things and I want them to align their starting position, or I want to align the dot in a bunch of decimals, you should use spaces because spaces give – basically spaces are saying I am specifically indenting to this exact character to align things.
Can I ask you – How many spaces is a tab in your mind?
I think of it as two.
Two?
It used to be four, but now I've changed to two.
Have you changed in the middle of a project?
No. No.
Brian?
The news is in. Stack Overflow has done the research. And developers who use spaces make more money than those that use tabs.
What are you talking about? That is bogus.
We're talking about more than $15,000 a year more money.
Okay, why? That's because Netflix uses spaces, doesn't it? I'll bet Netflix uses spaces. And Netflix pays a lot of money. Netflix pays higher than what?
Than like
98%
else,
or 99%. So, okay, answer me this. Does Netflix use spaces?
This is proprietary information.
Broken law.
Find out.
Are you opening up code right now?
Sure. Yeah, I got to find out what we think here.
I actually know Netflix uses spaces. I know this because a friend of mine who used to use tabs had to change and did so begrudgingly.
All right, so I am opening up a library that is the most common UI library.
On the iOS side?
No, cross iOS, Android, TV, and website.
Okay, while
it's spaces.
It's spaces. Boom. There it is. I will also say Facebook uses spaces.
Facebook pays really well too.
I think
you're just
Google
proving the point.
Uses spaces. I'm saying correlation and causation are not the same. And I know you were not saying that.
I was not. However,
but a lot of people are going to read that article and think, oh, I should change to spaces so I can make more money.
I am fairly sure if you change from tabs to spaces, you will not make more money.
I'm going to go back to every project I ever did and switch it to spaces.
No, it's
don't
open
do
source.
It manually.
You have to rewrite your Git history on that too.
Exactly. No, I was never able to prove this actually was published, but apparently, The Guardian published a reasoning in the first article and was called on it, took it down. But the initial reasoning that was apparently in this article that I could not confirm was that the researcher was saying that it comes down to the fact that people who are using tabs have so much less motivation to do work because they're so...
What?
Because they have all this, you know, they're not motivated to work, so they're just doing tabs. Those people who are using spaces, they're highly motivated and they're making more money.
Okay, if there's any software developers working at Facebook or at Netflix that you actually type four spaces to indent, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
You hit the tab key, your code editor changes that from tabs to spaces, hence me not knowing if it's spaces or tabs because it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you don't – yeah, and even if that weren't the case, you don't get paid per character.
And the other thing about syntax for us at Netflix, it's always based off of the file you're opening. If you're opening a new file, whatever it's doing, you do that.
Yeah.
Unless you're planning on rewriting that file completely, which is fine. So, yeah.
I made a course on this when I was at Udacity, or one of the parts of the course was about this, and I named it Be Tofu. Basically, take on whatever particular code seasoning there is in a particular file.
That's like, I want you to like go to a job interview and be like, so what's your best tactic? What's your best strategy? I am like tofu. I take on all others.
And they'll write in their interviewing feedback, very zen.
Very bland.
But not
he
very
says,
delicious.
Be tofu. Anyway.
Anyway, my answer is, why are we still using these long text files for programming?
Really?
Yeah. Programming is this non-linear thing. It's not like we're telling a long single story that starts from beginning to end.
That's true. But if you open up a file, that the code flow does not go linearly. I think the reason that we use text files are that they're, one, easy to store, two, easy to represent on a screen.
It's because you don't have to put so much work into your IDE to make a system that you can program in. That's what it comes down to. But
there's also standardization stuff. Like you don't want to make an IDE that supports something. So like there are historical reasons, right?
I think we use text because we haven't come up with a better way of doing it.
Yeah.
I think it's time. But I think we've been programming this way long enough.
I cannot imagine something as flexible as text. Maybe that, just
because,
stuck
because
in
all those
way.
Tools exist out there and they've existed for a long time and they've gotten really good.
I've written stuff in visual tools before and those things I can't open anymore.
Exactly.
That's true.
But there's multiple ways your code relates to each other. Wouldn't you like to be able to visualize it in multiple ways?
I love that
ways?
You work for
but
a company that does visual programming. Sounds like you're in your marketing hat right now.
No. The funny thing is that I used to spend all my time in computer graphics applications,
yeah,
moving nodes and connecting nodes from one thing to another, building up a scene of abstract stuff that became, you know, an image. But underneath it was all this abstract stuff that was connected with lines and
but were those things actually generating code? You're talking about in like Pixar when you're lighting a scene or something.
Yeah.
For those that
or
don't
like
know,
Node
like
or Nuke or Shake,
seen, like,
or whatever.
Monsters, Inc. And you're in the warehouse and there's that wonderful lighting. Yeah, Brian did that lighting.
So. I was involved in the big team that did that. But no, like,
I'll
like
edit you out when you're like, I was a part of it. No. You did the entire
take
movie.
Take a look at those credits.
This is like my mom saying like, oh my God, I asked you to talk to someone about being able to zoom photos on Instagram. And a week later, Ben had done it. She's telling her friends.
And you're like, I had nothing to do with that.
No, I know the building.
And you make all the videos on Facebook, right?
Every single one of them, yeah.
How many Facebook active users are there?
2 billion.
That's a lot of videos.
That's a lot of videos.
Actually, no, I should say 2 billion monthly actives.
Oh, okay.
1 point something daily actives. That's a huge amount.
That's a lot of people.
It's a huge amount of people.
That's a lot of videos.
Yeah. You want a job at Facebook, Lyle?
What were you talking
higher
about,
reach?
Brian?
I was talking about graphical representations for abstract things.
Right. Ah, okay. So when you were lighting, you're talking about the lighting or you're talking about skeletal stuff?
Compositing actually used it more.
Mm-hmm. What's compositing?
Compositing is layering images on top of each other. So in compositing, you might somebody was on a green screen, take out the green screen, put it over top of a beautiful background in New Zealand.
And that's basic compositing, and then you add more elements to make it look more realistic.
Yeah, yeah. And if you imagine drawing a graph out where you've got,
what's the thing that everybody's used to? A decision tree. That's not too common. But if you just have all these blocks that are connected by lines, and each one of those blocks represents something you're doing to that image. Maybe you're brightening it. Maybe you're making it more red. And then you can see how it flows through the graph as you do this. It's just a different
node-based compositing.
Exactly.
And actually, that is basically functional programming.
Right? Isn't there. It? Yeah.
Yeah, because each one of these nodes is pure. So whenever you give it the same input, it always gives the exact same output. And you can chain these things together to create some really complex logic. But you're saying, though,
I would love to view my code, the way these little methods are arranged in multiple different ways.
So I have a question. Yeah. Would it be enough if you could view your code that way?
Somewhat, but why stop there?
I think once you can view it well that way, that's how you'd access it to
then
edit
you,
it.
Then you could edit it, maybe.
Yeah. I definitely appreciate a good file structure tree when I'm dealing with stuff. And that tree definitely helps me use my spatial human abilities to understand where the code is. Mm-hmm. It definitely, a map is useful in developing. Normally, it's just a file structure on the side. But
Anyways.
I was just compositing today. I just put the final. We talked last week a bit about the interactive stuff that we're doing at Netflix, and we have another show coming out. And the show that just came out is Puss in Book, right? We mentioned this last week. And that little character, if you see it on the TV or iOS, he's animated. And I was just doing another one of those, and that actual animated thing is actually a composited video with a real-time image on top of it for, Ben, you'd like this, localization features. Because the logo on top, of course, is localized in many languages, but the video itself doesn't have to be. So, yeah, but I did all that by writing text.
I know.
I was compositing recently. I just recently composited a gajillion videos.
Talk about serious gajillion. Is that like a real word you use in Facebook?
Well, it's a perfect placeholder for the confidential number of what we actually generated.
And for more things than we can actually comprehend with our brains.
Well, that would be about 20.
No, you can comprehend more than 20.
You can comprehend 20 by grouping things in like
20
twos
groups.
And threes and fives and tens. But like we are not evolutionarily predisposed.
I can individually represent six.
You got your eyes closed, yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. I have no idea. I can do it at the same time. Yeah, you're right. We can't really do more than that. That's
which
amazing.
Which is why 1,000 blows my mind. And then if you do 1,000 of those, that's
Is that number the boundary of what we can actually comprehend as individuals? Is that where swarms occur? Like if you have three puppies, or if you have a puppy, it's cute. If you have three puppies, it's really cute. If you have five puppies, it's really cute. If you have 20 puppies, it's scary. Is that line where you're like, oh, that's not okay. It's too many.
I think it depends on how aggressive the puppies are.
Oh, no. I'm talking about
actually,
licks and loving.
Yeah, here's a question for you. Would you rather face a horse-sized duck?
Or a duck-sized
horse? Or 100 duck-sized horses?
I've heard this question somewhere.
Yeah. Maybe it was from me.
100?
Horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses?
So after he answers, raise or lower the number. Oh. You would go with what?
I'd go with the horses.
100
I've seen
duck-sized
ducks
horses?
Have sex, and I don't like ducks.
Oh, God.
I guess a female duck I wouldn't have a problem with, but a male duck, they're nasty
animals.
Can you
imagine how many horse-sized ducks there are if I say 100 horse-sized ducks? Duck-sized horses, excuse me.
That's just cute. Little horses are awesome.
What about, well,
okay,
duck-sized, they're not
Let me put
tiny.
It this way. Let me put it this
what
way.
What about
let me put it this way.
1,000?
I've seen ducks be jerks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
horses are intelligent and care about groupings. Ducks are just nasty. So you understand, like, from a herd perspective, a herd of a herding animal is not very scary to me if they can't actually trample me. So yeah, the
they
horses
would hurt your feet.
No, but are the horses and the duck both like after me in some way?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, they're after me, like they're
Why
literally
not?
After
of
me.
Course.
But I guess I just climb a tree and I'd be safe from the horses.
All right,
I'm going with horse.
That's valid.
100's a lot though.
What if they weigh as much as horses, but they're just really small?
Okay, that'd be so horrifying. So I think most of this is not being aired.
What are you talking about?
You mean all that time we're talking over each other? We never have to edit that out?
I actually kind of love it. Hey, that was – are we done?
Sure.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I want to keep talking with you guys, but we can do that in the car.
All right.
We're all going the same direction. All right.
Thank you, Lyle.
Next week. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Brian.
Buffalo.
Buffalo.
Buffalo.